Yes, we're talking money. We never have enough of it, do we? I am going to introduce our guest, Mary Beth McLean, who refers to herself as a financial caregiver. She has an MBA and is a certified financial planner, and she's the lead advisor to Private Vista. Hi, Mary Beth. How are you?
Very well, Karen. Thank you for having me.
Now, I want to warn everyone, this is not a boring conversation about money. We're not going to talk about how much you're putting in and how much you're not putting in, but we're going to talk about having a healthy relationship with money and some of the things that you've seen over the years, having represented people and helped people through trying times. Now, you generally work with everybody, but you have kind of a little focus on women who are in transition. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, a lot of the women that I work with have either gone through, unfortunately, a divorce and or lost their husband. And often, if they have not been what I call the financially engaged spouse, they need help in just kind of figuring out where all the assets are, how they have been managed, how they're going to manage going forward so that they can reduce their anxiety as it pertains to their finances.
As a lawyer, I agree that anxiety is usually generated by not knowing. And when people don't know and they don't have a grasp of things, they can't feel comfortable because it's just a blur to them and it causes great anxiety.
And they can't make good decisions. I mean, they've done studies where rationally you can't really make a good decision because of the anxiety, and the emotion is clouding your ability to reasonably come up with a good plan for yourself.
That's absolutely true. And we learn that in negotiation when we have settlement conferences, when you have people who are very highly agitated because of the divorce. You know, divorce is a very horrible time in people's lives, but they're not ready to divide up the property and make decisions about children because they're just so anxious and confused, really, about where they're going and what they're doing.
And sometimes it's easier to just stay still rather than trying to move forward if you don't know which direction you're going to go to.
And I'm going to say this is gender-neutral conversation because there are men who do not handle the finances, and I see that all the time in my practice. Why do you think one of the spouses perhaps doesn't pay attention to the money and has? I mean, I'm surprised when a woman or a man will say to me, I don't know how much my house is worth. I don't know what the mortgage balance is. I don't know what the monthly payments are. I don't know if we have any retirement. I don't even know what I spend on groceries.
I think that it starts out that there's kind of division of labor. So, you know, everybody kind of plays to their strengths in everything they do, whether it's a career. But even in marriage, there's a division, especially if there's children involved. One person is the primary person who makes the decision regarding the kids, and then the other person takes care of the finances. What happens is that when you know something's being taken care of, you don't necessarily get involved. And that's when I think it gets a little bit unsettling, or that uncertainty, and you just kind of say, okay, as long as it's being handled, I don't need to worry about it. But you don't need to worry about it, but you need to know about it.
Exactly. Now, tax day just passed us, and kind of a good time for a clean slate, would you say?
I agree. I think it's a great time to just take an assessment of where you are. The two things I would definitely want you to take a look at are your income tax refund. If you got an income tax refund of more than maybe $1,000 to $2,000, I think you really need to reconsider what you're doing with withholding in your paycheck, because you're giving Uncle Sam a completely, totally interest-free loan. So some people look at that and say, I'm going to get a refund, and it's kind of like a forced savings plan. But if you had started back in January of 2017, reducing your withholding, putting that in a 401k plan, you'd have a nest egg that was already continuing to grow for you.
Okay, so if you did not do that and you got a couple thousand dollars coming in, what do you suggest people do with it? Because I know people, they earmark it for all kinds of things like vacations and that type of thing, but what would you as a financial advisor say you should do with that money?
Well, if you don't already have if you're not regularly saving, I think you need to consider putting that into, you know, a 401k or increasing your 401k or paying down debt. But I really think you should be paying yourself first and making sure that that's part of your savings/retirement plan.
Mary Beth, you gave me a really good book called Loaded, and I read it very quickly, and it's fascinating because at least the first half of the book is about the psychology of money and why people face money in different ways and how some people growing up in kind of an impoverished situation, even though they succeed, they kind of go back to that impoverished situation, maybe because they're trying to replicate some family dynamic, as unhealthy as it might be. Do you see that on occasion with your clients?
Yes. I mean, money is a very objective thing, right? But there's a lot of emotion, which makes it a very subjective topic. So I think that people, when whatever their background is, they grow up with preconceived notions about what money can do for you, what the perception of people that have money versus people that don't have money. And I think that you carry that into adulthood.
There was a quote, I'm going to read it. Money is probably the most emotionally meaningful object in contemporary life. Only food and sex are its close competitors, as common carriers of such strong and diverse feelings, significance, and strivings. And I read that sentence several times, and I couldn't agree more with that.
And the other thing I think that she says constantly in her book is that money is not just about the numbers, it's about the emotion that you feel about regarding money.
Now, let's talk about credit cards. Credit cards is like free money. It's like monopoly money. It doesn't count. There's no limit. But you do know when you have $20 in your wallet and you know when that's gone. What's your advice to people on how to curb that spending?
I think the first thing you should do is never spend more than you are able to pay off at any given month. So a credit card gives people a sense that they can spend more than they have, and you can because they're going to extend a limit to you. But then when you have to pay that back, if you bought something, it's going to be used by the time you probably fully paid for it if you don't ever fully pay the balance off at the end of the month after you've bought that object. So I think you have to be very careful that the credit card is something that you need, but I don't think you should ever extend it beyond what you're able to pay off in any given month.
We're talking to Mary Beth McLean, who is a lead advisor in Private Vista. If you have any questions for her about money, savings, or the like, give us a call here at 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. We're talking money with Mary Beth McLean, who's the lead advisor of Private Vista. Fact, 64% of Americans say money is a significant source of stress in their lives. 62% say they lose sleep over it, and a quarter of all Americans say they are stressed about money most or all of the time. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. I think that so many people are afraid to talk about money, and they don't like to talk about money.
Why is that? And it's true. No one wants to talk about what they have or what the markets are doing. People kind of, they gaze off into the sunset and don't want to talk about it. Why?
Well, the first thing I think is that people are embarrassed that maybe their life may not be as glamorous as we think that they might be leading, the life that they might be leading. You know, we live in this instant world and with Instagram and everything, and maybe they just don't want to share that maybe they're not going to be able to live that lifestyle. So I think that's number one. I think that there's a sheepishness about being able to talk about money, because if you feel you can't make intelligent conversation with somebody, you're not going to engage in those conversations, right? You're just going to kind of avoid them. And then the third thing, I think, is knowledge. People, you know, there is a lot of mumbo-jumbo and financial jargon, and sometimes if people don't know that they don't know something, they don't know how to start the conversation to ask.
I don't know about you, but when I grew up in my family, we didn't talk about money. And that was something that, you know, I had no idea what my parents made or didn't make. I didn't know anything about our finances, and I'm not sure that children are supposed to know, but it was just something that was a hush-hush topic.
I would agree. People don't talk about money, and generally people don't talk about, parents don't talk about their money situation with their kids, and they should, because as we get older, it's important for your kids to know where your assets are, kind of what your wishes are, because if you don't let them know that, they're not going to be able to execute the things that you might like to have done.
On that topic, children. You have children, and you've been in money basically your whole professional life in one way, shape, or form. What are some of the things that you've done, and what are some of the things that our listeners can do with their children and grandchildren to to try to get them to be financially savvy and responsible?
Well, the first thing, I think sometimes you're going to have to let them blow it. I mean, you have to give them an opportunity to make mistakes with it. So hopefully they start making those earlier when you give them an allowance and they want to go to that local street fair and they blow it on the guy, you know, that wants them to throw the basket through the hoop, and you know it's rigged. But you have to let them make those mistakes because that's how they learn. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is even as a young person, the thing to know, and you should tell your kids this, is to start saving early. Time truly is on their side. So you know, even when kids are young, if they're babysitting or they've got that first job, I always say, you know, open up, and we did this with our kids, is open up a Roth IRA, and I matched what they would put in there. And it really makes them understand that, you know, when you go to an employer and that's a benefit, that, you know, getting that matching program and starting the saving early is really very beneficial.
When, you know, I guess I come from kind of a middle class background, a very modest background, and I see a lot of my friends who became professionals, all of a sudden they're making very good money and their spouses are making money, and now they have these children. And the children are going to good schools, and they see their friends wearing the $500 pair of jeans, and they're going to Switzerland to go skiing for spring break. How do you, again, this is a parent kind of answer more than a financial advisor, but how would you view making decisions for your children about whether to give them what you didn't have versus making them work for it?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do for your kids. That doesn't mean that you should do it. And I think that you want your kids to live a good life and you want them to be financially responsible. If you're always giving them those things, you're not really teaching them to be financially responsible. And you're giving them a sense of entitlement, which I think down the road is going to do them a disservice.
What are the top three mistakes, or more if you have, with people handling their money?
I think the first thing is to not pay yourself first, to be able to start saving in a retirement plan that either is an employee-offered benefit or your own, but to pay yourself first. The second is to live within your means and not overextend your credit cards. And the third is to invest. It's not enough to just say you're going to save. You have to invest. And that doesn't mean you have to be a real aggressive investor, but you do need to make sure that that money starts working for you. Let your money earn money for you.
If you have a woman in transition who you're going to counsel, say she's going through a divorce, what is the general game plan? How do you approach her, and what are the first things you do, and how do you walk her through the process?
Well, the first thing I want to always do is listen to her, because she's going to have certain anxieties that we want to make sure we address. So the first thing is to kind of go through, figure out what the assets are, listen to the lifestyle that she may have led, and then try and figure out what her lifestyle is going to be going forward, because there's been a seismic shift. If there's a divorce, there's been a huge change in the lifestyle that she's going to lead going forward, and we want to make sure that she understands the assets that she has, that she can understand she'll be making decisions for herself, but to be financially empowered. It's the not knowing, I think, that is the scariest. So it's to be able to take a lot of unknowns and help them figure out what that next chapter is going to look like financially.
Mary Beth, you and I both deal with a lot of people in what we call transition. I call it chaos. You might call it transition. But I find, and again, I see this in myself. I'm not saying that I'm any different at all. But change is hard for people. And change, when it's foisted upon you, is difficult. And you have to readjust your life as quickly as you can in a way that makes sense. But some people just aren't able to do it. And I see this when people maybe are getting divorced and they have a big house and they just can't give up that beautiful house. And yes, you want it for the children and to send them to a good school, but there should be downsizing, and you know there should be downsizing, and they can't do it. How do you help people move to, I mean, you can't make that decision for them.
Right.
But how do you guide them in the right direction?
We sit down and we actually start to talk about the house and what it means to them. And then I start to say, and that's okay, but if you were going to keep the house, remember that the house, it might provide an emotional respite or haven for you, but that's going to cost X amount of dollars. So if you're going to keep the house, spouse, you're probably going to have to make a bigger adjustment somewhere else in your lifestyle. And remember that a house is not just the mortgage. It's the maintenance that goes into a home. It could be landscaping. It could be raking the leaves, shoveling. All of those things cost money, and so you have to be willing to say, that's where I want to stay. And I'm willing to give up other pieces of my lifestyle, especially given the expense of the house, in order to do that. So we will work through that. And many times they find that it is more productive and conducive for the next chapter to let the house go and find a smaller home.
And one of the things that I do is I tell them to go out and look at homes, because sometimes they get excited about something smaller and more manageable, or maybe something in a condo association where there is no shoveling and there is no landscaping, and they start to then picture their future. And when someone I find, they can actually visualize what that future looks like, they can start making those decisions a little bit more quickly.
I also think that there's a social aspect to it, too, that sometimes being in the house might be isolating. So if you move to a condo or a townhome subdivision, those kind of things, they can provide you some new welcome company, too.
Absolutely. And sometimes a home has some bad memories. So
that's true, too.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk briefly before we go about retirement. What are you seeing in what people want in retirement?
I don't know if I would use the word retirement anymore. I think that you might be leaving the current profession, but a lot of people are finding really exciting new things to happen as they leave one career and maybe start another. And it could be that they get paid, it could be a volunteer position, but I don't think that you necessarily, there's a great book called The New Retirementality, and they talk about that you're not retiring from something, but they are actually retiring to something. And I think that what we do at Private Vista is help them figure out what that next vision for their life is going to be and help them execute it.
Mary Beth, tell everyone how we can reach you.
Well, you can either email me at mbmclean@myprivatevista.com, or you can also visit our website, which is www.myprivatevista.com.
And could you tell us really quickly what Project Venus is?
Project Venus is a great new initiative I started with one of my colleagues, Nicole Romito. And what we're doing is developing a community for women to start learning, becoming more financially literate. So, and it's a non-judging, welcoming community. So we have different events. We have people like you come and talk to us and our clients that will give them information about divorce, about retirement, and we're going to try and do some fun things too.
And I've been at a few of the events, and they're really fabulous. They're fun. They're a lot of fun, good networking, fun to meet people, and always learn something new, which is great. Mary Beth McLean, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Okay.